Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
On October 25th, 1848, Bostonians gathered on Boston Common for a spectacular moment in the city's history. Mayor Josiah Quincy Jr. gave the signal and workers opened a valve and a gush of water shot toward the sky, towering above the trees and buildings, reflecting the crimson rays of the setting sun. Boston's public water supply was born, and that explosion of water on that October afternoon represented a dramatic moment in a long debate about the role and responsibilities of government that continues to this day.
Nowhere was there this kind of deep, profound, and even at times bitter debate of not only of water, but the large issue of what should government be and do.
Carl Smith tells the story in his new book, City Water, City Life. He's a professor of English and American Studies and a professor of history at Northwestern University. And Professor Smith, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Take us back to the early 19th century in Boston, before there was a publicly administered water supply. How did people get their water?
People got it every which way. Many of them got it from wells, either their own or nearby. Some of them got it from, if they could afford it, piped into them from a private company called the Boston Aqueduct that drew on Jamaica Pond. Others bought it from watermen who carried around in kegs, and of course you had to be able to afford it. Some got it from the Charles River. Some got water that was quite compromised.
So, I mean, literally people might be hauling it in buckets at that point.
Absolutely. Many people were hauling it in buckets, either from their own wells or from ones in the neighborhood or a few public ones. One problem was as the city was growing, the natural sources were both disappearing and becoming increasingly compromised.
So as you write, Bostonians were engaged in a profound debate about how their city should work and who should take responsibility for meeting its basic needs. So who was the major proponent of a publicly administered water supply?
Well, there were a few different people, starting with Mayor Quincy's father, also named Josiah Quincy, who later quite a career, later became president of Harvard, and Quincy Market is named after him. He said it should be public. A major spokesman was a professor of medicine, a doctor at the Harvard Medical School, Walter Channing, who saw this not only as a kind of health issue, but also as a moral one. Again, this was a fairly widespread belief, but one with plenty of opposition, plus various conditions that worked against it.
And I want to ask you about that opposition, but first, there's a great quote. There are a bunch of great quotes, but one in particular from Mayor Josiah Quincy Sr. talking about the need for a public water supply. He said, "No private capitalists will engage in such an enterprise without a reasonable expectation of profit." He
Yes.
argued that the city should provide the best water at the lowest cost for everybody.
Right. What you have to remember here is that city government at this point is very limited, and the mayor of Boston was a very weak figure politically, and most people involved in city politics at this point were businessmen themselves who really believed in free enterprise and as much as possible letting the market take care of things. But in this particular area, people were saying that there's just the interests of a private corporation and the interests of the city really diverged. The city really wanted the most and the best water for everyone, not just for altruistic reasons, but because it was vital to everyone being healthy, to industry thriving, to attracting new people to the city. The problem was that if a company has a major interest, desire to make money on it, their interests and the city's might diverge.
So who opposed it? It was business interests that opposed it, but who were they and what were their arguments against a publicly administered water supply?
Well, in some ways, they're similar to arguments we hear today, that private industry could do it better, could do it cheaper. At that point, they could make very powerful the argument that they had a track record. The government providing something like water had no precedent in terms of its expense, in terms of its expanse, in terms of the technical expertise involved. And they say, leave it to us. We know how to do these kinds of things, like the owners of the Boston Aqueduct who were doing it. There are also people who were not just wanting private enterprise, but were averse to having the city do it. This involved going into debt on an unprecedented scale.
Sure, and of course today when we think about municipal bonds and the way cities raise money and going into debt, it's sort of standard operating procedure, but,
yes.
But not back then.
One very interesting thing about the history of city water is that this is the start of this kind of major borrowing. This is when municipal bonds really come into full use.
So how loud, how dominant was this debate in that day? Did it sort of take up a lot of oxygen in the city?
Absolutely. First of all, it went on and off for 20 years between the mid-1820s and the mid-1840s. But it all came to a head in 1845 when it became clear the city just had to do something, and there were two leading possibilities. One was a private company providing the water, and the other was a city-owned one. It just absolutely filled the front pages of newspapers. There were meetings of people favoring or against it in Faneuil Hall and other places throughout the city. It just consumed a tremendous amount of oxygen, to use your term, and it came down to a referendum.
They rejected it the first time around, right?
By a very narrow margin, in part for yet another reason. They're feeling that this created, again, something we hear today, a too powerful a bureaucracy that was not accountable to the people. And that was probably the deciding thing. And then a revised charter was passed the following spring.
And they pass it by a pretty big majority.
Over
90%. Which brings us to that spectacular autumn afternoon on Boston Common in 1848 that you described. How big an event was this?
It was enormous. The city's population then was about 130,000. The estimates of the people involved in the celebration go up to starting at least 50,000 up to 100,000 or more. An enormous parade winding its way through the downtown with floats of all kinds, and then these ceremonies on the common itself with the mayor and various others giving speeches, and the water being then officially turned on, and that great fountain rising in the common, and people even weeping when they saw it.
Now, you write that what happened in Boston influenced what happened in the rest of the country. So did this sort of ignite the debate about what government should do and what it should be responsible for and how involved it should be in people's lives?
As we well know today, that debate is
alive and well.
It's alive and well.
Yeah.
It certainly ignited it far more in Boston. I mean, Boston was not the first place to build. It was one of the first, but not the very first. But nowhere was there this kind of deep, profound, and even at times bitter debate. You see broadsides that say, vote nay, nay, nay. You're going to be subjected to this terrible monster. Nowhere was it like this, and it certainly influenced things further on. Still, the inclination was to do things privately.
I want to ask a little bit about the sort of nature of the undertaking. You touched on it briefly, but this proposal involved a huge undertaking.
Absolutely.
An ambitious project of aqueducts, bridges, tunnels.
Feeling their way, yes,
yeah.
and trial and error. That is to say that the source, the public source, was a place called Long Pond. We now know it as Lake Kitchewett. The Mass Pike runs through it. It's about 19 miles west of downtown. But then you had to get the water to Boston, and that involved an aqueduct over very uneven terrain. So for parts it had to go on bridges, and parts it was in the ground, and parts it went through tunnels. They had to negotiate rights with all the towns in between. And it was just absolutely a major event. Crews working around the clock, part of the system building the receiving reservoir in Brookline that's still there by Route 9. It's not part of the system anymore. And these reservoirs I talked about, one in the South End and one on Beacon Hill.
You write so interestingly earlier in the book, the city as an infrastructure of ideas. I like this double meaning, an infrastructure of ideas. What are you getting at there?
What I'm getting at there is that cities are made out of ideas as well as out of bricks and mortar, and the two are inseparable from one another. That's to say, when you build this aqueduct, it expresses the ideas that animated Boston as an urban democracy and all the policies related to it, the decision on who should pay, who should get it for free, who should manage it. A lot of the discussion about tapping Long Pond is that this idea that God put it there and put it there at a height that gravity would enable us to get the water to Boston without pumps. It was kind of a reaffirmation of Boston as God's city, as a city on a hill, based on an idea of what they think Boston could be and should be. and it involves also ideas of where they see themselves in relation to the cities they're competing with, whether New York or Philadelphia or others.
Sure. And while we take for granted today that this idea that a city government runs the local water supply, in many ways, as we've mentioned, this debate about the role of government continues to play out today. The role of government in healthcare, public transportation, among other issues. Are we conducting these debates in the same way as we did back then, or how do you think about that?
The short answer is no, in a kind of on-the-ground way. What's so impressive about the Boston one is how much it was part of daily conversation and how much it was a very local discussion of not only of water, but the large issue of what should government be and do. And in many ways, they're sort of setting ideas that we sort of take for granted now. These debates in the city and in public forums about what water should be go back to the town meeting. It's so much more mediated now in so many ways.
Finally, let me ask you about this. You talk about the ideas, the infrastructure of ideas that animate a city. Mm-hmm. I know in your research, you've obviously become very familiar with Boston today. And do you still see those ideas from early and mid-19th century Boston that animated it then animating it today?
Oh, yes, I think very much so. I mean, it's, you know, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse. And when I think of worse, you know, the kind of controversies about busing, famously, a while ago. But recently, this whole idea of Boston strong in relation to the marathon bombings, a sense of group responsibility, a sense of how do we live together in this place and what kind of a place do we want it to be and do we insist it will be?
Well, Carl Smith, it's such an interesting story, and it's been great talking to you about it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Carl Smith is a professor of English and American Studies, as well as history at Northwestern University. He's the author of City Water, City Life, Water and the Infrastructure of Ideas in Urbanizing Philadelphia, Boston, and Chicago. You can read an excerpt from his book at radioboston.org.